forced displacement of black folks in the city of Portland. So every time we thought we could settle, here comes some other legal something to uproot us and move folks out. So what has happened to black people is very different, and it's very distinct for reasons that I've already mentioned. Other communities have been allowed to settle, have been allowed to grow roots, have been allowed to gain social and political capital. They have been allowed to establish a firm tax base that benefits their communities.
Is there anything else you would like to say before we finish this off?
I would like to say that this lawsuit, that the lawsuit, the litigation was unprecedented, but what the city council members did was also unprecedented. I don't know of any history of a settlement going before city council and city council saying, wait a second, this something about this isn't right and we need to correct it. And I also need to highlight that this lawsuit came forward because of the intellect, tenacity, and dedication of one person, a black woman, who took the time and worked diligently to bring this forward. I think we need to highlight that more.
You have been listening to News in Depth, an interview with Bird, the founder of Emmanuel Displaced Persons Association 2, about the recent...
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
It's time to pack your trunk and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a summer of memories with KBOO and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Strike for Our Rights, presenting a screening of the documentary Union on June 23rd at the Clinton Street Theater. The film chronicles the efforts of a group of warehouse workers as they launch a grassroots union campaign at an Amazon fulfillment center. All proceeds go to the Strike for Our Rights Strike Fund. Tickets and info at cstpdx.com.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
Thank you so much for joining us. We would first just like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. Be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org. And before we get started, I want to let you all know that KBOO has been on the air for 55 years, making us one of the oldest community radio stations in the country and one of the longest standing media institutions in Portland. And we've been able to remain commercial-free, volunteer-powered resource for this community because of the support of amazing people like you. In fact, 80% of the station's funding comes from the generosity of our members. So if you can, please help us continue to serve the wonderful community by donating today. Just go to kboo.fm/give. And we here at Labor Radio thank you so much for your support. So today we are going to be diving into the effects of the first 100 days of the second Trump administration here. I mean, honestly, it feels like it's been way more than 100 days at this point.
Yes.
But it has been just over 100. So really, the relentless onslaught of shocking news, unhinged executive orders, and attacks on the public good during just these 100 days has been very much by design. It follows, you know, a well-worn page of Steve Bannon's playbook. So like basically by flooding the zone with chaos, you leave your opponents reeling and unable to mount a response to any single atrocity. You know, you flood the zone with chaos and multiple atrocities and shocking news articles, and no one can focus on any one thing that you're attempting to do. And so really what unites the excesses of the authoritarian power being exercised by Trump and his regime is that they all represent new fronts in the waging of unrestricted class warfare against labor and working people, a strategy calibrated to really the interests of capital and the capitalist class. This regime has tactically dispensed with longstanding precedents, trampled guardrails against authoritarianism, thrown open the door for wanton profiteering, and maneuvered to strike a severe blow to the labor movement. And history has proven that the capitalist class is willing to accede to dictatorship as long as it can secure the regime's collaboration in pursuing its unattainable goal of infinite profit. And through his actions, Trump has made it clear to the agents of capital that they can count on his regime's help in the struggle against workers' collective power. Trump and his collaborators have already signaled that they're willing to discard with democracy and sacrifice human life without regret for this aim. Just a few things here. He's reduced workers' wages, made workplaces less safe, threatened workers' retirement savings by destabilizing the global economy, and gutted government offices that administer fundamental programs covering millions of people in the United States, such as Social Security and Medicare. And that's just to name, sort of the top level things that have happened. So today we're going to go into some of the more granular ways that this administration has attacked working people, both in their workplace and their means of earning a living, but also in their general safety, like the working class's safety in general. So first, we're going to look at the ways that they've directly attacked workers' wages. Most notably, the Trump regime has reduced the minimum wage for federal contractors, which could cost these lower wage workers anywhere from 25 to 60% in pay cuts. They've also repealed an order directing agencies to prioritize, quote, high road employers, which are basically employers that agree to pay workers the prevailing wage and provide benefits like paid leave and health insurance during the process of awarding federal contracts. So essentially, when any agency is looking to award a federal contract, they no longer have to select the option that would pay workers the highest or, the best wages and provide the best benefits. They can go for the lowest, the bottom rung there if they want, the lowest bid exclusively. And also the Trump regime has eliminated federal incentives for programs that provide workers on federal projects with training opportunities for higher wage skilled trades and occupations. So, cut off both the regulatory demands of workers getting paid fair wages, and also dealt blows to their ability to get trained and trade up into better jobs.
Yeah, and I think when somebody thinks about a governmental position, I think most of the time you're thinking about stability and some sort of environment in which you can kind of count on the work and the pay that's coming your way. And these are kind of the largest factors in drawing talent to the federal government. Before Trump and after Trump, you're never going to be able to earn the highest wages working at a federal agency than you could in the private sector. But at least in the past, you could kind of count on stability and more control of your work and life. And so, without these factors, not only does it hurt the short term, but, how does the government itself keep talent, train talent, to your point, especially when higher skill trades are not being, money's not being handed out to train those skills. And so, where is the labor going to come from essentially, right? When kind of this was usually the point in time for America where it's kind of the canary in the coal mine of, okay, are we going to start seeing workers take advantage of certain things or take advantage of opportunities, or are they going to get treated poorly? And I think we're seeing the latter, and you know, it does not bode well for work getting done by the government itself.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a good point too, that, you know, yeah, obviously no one should have been getting rich working for the federal government, but it was absolutely a path to the middle class for working people, you know, taking a job that had good pay and benefits, and also, you know, kind of most importantly, like labor protections. You know, the federal sector, yeah, the public sector is the largest sector of union density in this country. And that, of course, and we, you know, we talked about this even before the Trump administration took over, but just like that was obviously the goal of any, you know, MAGA president or, you know, conservatives in general, is to destroy the last bastion of union strength, and that is in the federal workforce and the public sector. Yeah. And so that's, of course, what they're going after here.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And you know, if you take away the only thing that was driving people to go somewhere, then you're not going to get as many of them because they're going to go make higher wages. You know, obviously, neither you or I were there, yeah, but I can remember my grandparents talking about the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And most of the only positive things that I would ever hear about either side of the family is, on one side, somebody had a post office job.
Yeah.
Right. And this is the thing is, you know, you were making lower wages the whole time, but guess what? You kind of were able to skirt by and kind of survive these things. And that stability is no longer there.
Right. Like, that's exactly it. You know, especially during a time of economic uncertainty, a public sector job is a stable thing to have.
Yeah. You know? And it allows you to recruit people that you wouldn't normally be able to get with the wages that you're paying. Exactly. And so, again, you know, I not to beat a dead horse, but I think the wages are an important factor here, because when you're lowering already low wages, that's not how you train, attract, and gather talent.
Yeah. And it also just sets a bad precedent. You know, union jobs having higher wages then sets the bar higher for even non-unionized workers. And when you attack that, it means that every, you know, you attack that and the base level drops for everyone, yeah, unfortunately. You know, so along with just direct attacks on wages, this administration has also gone after, you know, worker protections. They fired nearly two-thirds of the staff, so roughly 870 employees of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, which is an agency created to ensure safety and healthy working conditions for this reduction essentially eliminated divisions of the agency focused on the health and safety of miners, you know, people working in mines, firefighters, and healthcare workers. So three pretty essential safety, you know, jobs that really do need workplace safety protections.
And obviously within the first, you know, several days of the administration, the cuts to the FAA were kind of very in the news, right? And you know, I think we had gone somewhere in the 15 years without actually a commercial plane crash or something like that. And obviously, right, the cuts to the FAA immediately resulted in that. I think these are going to be way less visible over the coming years, right? These are the sorts of things that the general population doesn't see or interact with, but are going to cause huge problems.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be a snowball that kind of catches speed going downhill.
Like, it won't, you know, don't be surprised if you hear about miners getting trapped in a mine because of, you know, they didn't have proper safety precautions, or, you know, something even more close to home, like, you know, say there are fewer firefighters who are able to show up for, you know, blazes in your neighborhood or something like that because there are less protections or less demands on how many you have to be there. Those type, or, you know, of course, healthcare workers too.
Yeah. You know, and obviously in our own backyard here in Oregon, we have pretty strong nurses unions, right? Which we've talked about on the show. Not every part of the United States has that. So, you know, healthcare workers are in here, and, you know, depending on, it really just puts a lot more pressure on, you know, less codified and solid parts of our infrastructure. And so, you know, we're just going to have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah. And, you know, just to circle back to sort of what you were saying before, too, it was the first big thing that we saw within the first week of Trump's second term here was cuts to the FAA and then immediately a series of high profile air accidents. And then, you know, more recently, we're seeing what's happened at Newark Airport and, you know, cascading through other airports where air traffic controllers, their union, their workplaces have been unsafe. They have not been allowed to hire the right staffing people, you know, numbers of staff. And then now we're seeing them having, you know, having to leave the workplace for, you know, to deal with traumatic events, like having their communication with all airplanes cut off for a few minutes and things like that. So, you know, these are things that, of course, are going to affect those workers in their workplaces. But it just so happens that their workplaces are also are the places that where the general public exists and expects top level safety.
Yep.
You know, air travel is nothing, you know, is nothing to be to mess around with. And if those people, the people doing the work are unsafe, we are all unsafe if we're trying to travel. And it's also the only way that, you know, we don't have high speed rail in this country. We only have air travel. And so if that becomes unsafe, we are all of a sudden disconnected.
Yeah.
You know, we can't just
And the economic impacts too, right? Of like so many places in America require you know, people visiting there as part of their economy and all this sorts of things. So I mean, it's just the butterfly effect here is kind of massive in terms of what we're going to see happen all around.
Yeah, that's actually that's a really good point too, that you know, of course, on top of all those other things, if air travel is unsafe and if workplaces are unsafe, so much of the economy of this country is based on tourism too. And if people don't from the rest of the world don't feel safe for so many different reasons, whether it's, you know, being stopped by customs and border patrol or ICE or anything other things, but if they don't, if they see the best aviation system, safety system in the world, all of a sudden falling, you know, letting planes fall out of the sky and crash and things like that, people won't feel safe coming to this country. And they won't feel safe spending their tourist dollars here. And that's going to affect workers and the economy, you know, on a much broader scale as
Absolutely.
Well. Yeah. Just to keep going through this list here of other ways that worker protections have been under attack, though, the administration has also, they stalled the implementation of a rule that would protect minors from silica exposure, leaving minors less safe and at greater risk of black lung disease, a thing that, you know, seems very much like a 19th century concern, but of course we are just, you know, doing the 19th century over again. And so we're going to hear about increased risk for black lung of people in mines, because the Trump administration has also said that they are going to basically move away from any type of green energy, and we want to reopen the mines to get people back into mines. So there could be an explosion of issues like that that we haven't heard about for 100 years coming back around. They also fired 90% of the staff at an office in the Department of Labor that ensured that federal contractors abide by anti-discrimination laws, and canceled grants for programs to combat forced and child labor around the world, which also protected jobs and workers in the U.S. by deterring unfair competition from imports produced with forced labor. So that's scary. That's basically just making workers in this country, as well as workforces around the world, less safe. I don't see the positive benefits there, except for to the bottom line of the people who are owning, you know, paying those workers. They have also delayed the defense of a Biden-era rule that made it harder for employers to misclassify workers as independent contractors. That's a thing that we have discussed at length on this show. But, you know, it really did seem like we were moving in the right direction over the last, you know, the past 4 years towards cracking down on the misclassification of, you know, contractors who really are employees, but saying they're independent contractors. You see this most with like Uber and Lyft and those types of rideshare companies. But also there are plenty of other workers who are misclassified in that way.
The gig economy, we've talked about it so many times on this show, and you know, it's really a way to kind of take away the 200 plus years of work that unions have done here, right, in order to strip people of rights kind of without them being able to fight back. So a huge blow.
Absolutely. Yeah, and unfortunately it's probably not the last we'll see of that. And the administration has also terminated the Department of Labor grants that that fought forced and child labor and promote workers' rights. So, you know, not only are they taking away the protections for that and the incentives for companies not to engage in those types of practices, but they're also getting rid of grants that would help fight forced and child labor and promote workers' rights. So that's scary stuff. And then, you know, moving on to another subset of the ways they've attacked workers here, there has also been unprecedented attacks on unions and collective bargaining rights. You know, pretty quickly into the first 100 days, the Trump regime fired the National Labor Relations Board member.
Gwynne Wilcox.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. Missed the name there. But, you know, did so for, quote, unduly disfavoring the interests of employers, end quote, which, you know, made very clear that Trump's expectation is that the labor board and their, you know, members of the labor board would basically side exclusively with employers. Like, that is what they're, that that's what they see them as being there for, despite the fact that really the role of the NLRB is to be an impartial judge, but also to try and promote labor rights and union rights.
Yeah. And you know, we don't typically get super into policy on this show that often. But I will call out here, too, that a lot of the firings on the NLRB are also being contested as illegal.
Yes.
In the first place. And so I think an important thing to call out here is just the lawlessness that's being created, right? It's basically open season for private sector C-suite, you know, executives to treat employees how they've been wanting to treat them this entire time. Because even if you have an intact NLRB or intact kind of labor laws, it just seems like this administration is causing as much kind of pain as possible, and just outright ignoring or pretending not to understand existing laws. And so I think the amount of lawlessness, I think, cannot be understated. And I think people are feeling, you know, they're feeling that energy, and then they're kind of taking it with what they will and just outright breaking laws.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, you know, you're seeing that in the way that employers are dealing with employees. You're seeing that on the governmental level, but you're also seeing it kind of being embodied by just individual citizens around. Like, people are seeing the lawlessness that is being perpetrated from the top and taking that upon, like, basically internalizing that and saying, okay, well, if the people in charge don't have to follow the rules, like, I no longer have to.
I mean, one of the things we talk about all the time is one of the most powerful parts of the executive branch is you get to help determine how things are executed.
Yes.
Normally that meant within the letter of the law and then, you know, maybe dictating, you know, inside of that. But now it just means we're going to make our own readings of things. You know, we won't get into it here, but we've talked about on the show whether or not kind of we as a country, and I would argue both the left and the right, have gone too far with executive orders, right? Those are really not supposed to be able to rewrite laws. They're supposed to affect how they're carried out. And I think, you know, this is a prime example of, obviously he didn't use an executive order here, but this is the executive branch of the government overstepping its kind of understood, or even in sometimes outright written in the Constitution, you know, abilities and power.
Yeah. It is sort of like the logical end state of, like, the unitary executive theory that was pushed during the Bush administration, of just, like, the president, the executive branch, being able to exert their power over the other two co-equal branches simply through, you know, executive order and things like that.
Well, I mean, like we said, the administration has just stopped following the rules and is openly ignoring even existing kind of contracts. You know, with agencies, you know, obviously the executive order that he did that basically declared unions to be illegal, that was actually done under the context of with the state of national security, like if national security is involved. But, you know, he even threw things in there like the FDA, which, again, I think you would have to go to the courts. But, you know, in March, there was a mass layoff at the FDA, and, you know, their existing collective bargaining agreement required that they be notified of any mass firings over a certain amount, and they just basically ignored it, right? So we're kind of pen to ink doesn't seem to matter right now.
Yeah, and, you know, they can move quickly. You know, the classic tech sector idea of, like, move fast and break things. Like, their approach seems to be that, you know, yeah, flooding the zone. Like, you move quickly, you break all these things, and then the legal system cannot catch up in time to rectify these. You know, so sure, you fire a bunch of people at the, you know, FAA or, you know, any federal workforce, and then maybe it's determined later that that was completely illegal and those people need to be rehired. But those people have already, it has been months or years.
Yeah, and they can't sit around.
Yeah, and they don't have the ability to get all those people back. And in the meantime, the work that those people were doing, the critical work, is not being done. You know, yeah, like you said, like the FDA, pretty important for protecting food safety in this country. Mm-hmm. Like, how many people are going to get sick because of that in the time that it takes to realize that, for the courts to rectify the problem? So, and that seems like the cruelty of it does seem to be the ultimate point. Yeah. It's to fully break the government and the role of the government as being something that can help people and provide stability and safety and protections for the people, so that people finally, you know, no longer trust government at all, and this administration can just keep moving forward, breaking things and breaking the law, because no one will think that they do anything else.
I mean, I think, you know, not to be super, you know, old man yells at clouds, not that we're old here on the show, but, you know, I think there used to be arguments about policy, right? And there used to be differences between the left and the right on policy, right? I think if you wanted to make an argument, right, that the federal government should have less power, and we should use that to attack the deficit and the debt, I think that makes sense, right? And maybe not sense, but, you know, I could understand an argument, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, right? And we could kind of live in reality, and we could have a conversation. I think it's hard to follow what's happening here, because it doesn't seem like there's an outcome, at least that I can see, that people are going for, right? You know, you're making these cuts to agencies, and obviously in order to save money, but then your tax cuts on the other side are going to raise the debt. Yeah. So it's, and the deficit, and, you know, Trump has, even in his first term, ran a huge deficit. So, you know, I think that's where I seem to be at a little bit of a loss, where I'm not really sure what are the intended outcomes, other than to your point of, okay, we're just getting rid of woke, and we're cutting jobs that we don't think are necessary, and, you know, eliminating waste. But I mean, even on Doge's kind of best calculations, the deficit is so much bigger than what Doge could ever cut, right? If we actually want to do that, you know, we would actually have to sit down as a country and decide, like, what do we care about and what don't we care about? And cutting USAID is not going to get you to where you want to go, especially if you're not kind of working together across the aisle to say, okay, we care about the deficit and we want to do something about it. That's not what's happening. So it can be difficult to follow, because it seems, like we said, lawless and kind of random.
Yeah. I mean, really, like, it's the only way that it can be made sense of is basically looking, like, in the aggregate, all of the actions that are being taken, the only thing, like, the true outcome that makes sense is that their goal is to just break the government and enrich themselves and their cronies. Like, that's it. Anything beyond that goal doesn't make sense and isn't logically being mapped onto their actions. Like, they're the only things that the true outcome of all of this chaos is to just get rich and to have no consequences for it. Nothing else makes sense. Unfortunately, we are running low on time. So just going to quickly, we're going to skip through a bunch of these things, but basically, like, you know, it's undeniable that the actions that are being undertaken by Trump in these first 100 days, you know, Trump and all of his agents there, within the federal government during the first 100 days, have moved us further towards the ultimate aims of the reactionary right and, you know, the MAGA movement, which are permanent hierarchy and corporate rule, mutually interlocked with unfettered powers of state repression. So essentially, like, state capitalist fascism. And, you know, while some of Trump's policies have been stopped in the courts and are, you know, actively being challenged in the courts, he's demonstrated a willingness to disregard the rule of law completely.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just going to leave all of us working people more vulnerable to the whims of him, you know, him and his advisors and the billionaire class in general.
And I think it's going to take a little time to feel it, right? You know, people's 401ks are hurting right now, but, you know, we haven't actually felt the supply chain ramifications. Right. And, you know, I don't think all of the firings and layoffs has come. So, you know, I think buckle up.
Yeah,
because we're in it right now.
Like, it's just starting. You know, the ports have been empty for a while. I don't think that we've quite seen the downstream effects of that. So, yeah, obviously, you know, there is unfortunately more to come with this. This is just the building storm here. Mm-hmm. But we, of course, will continue to follow these stories and bring them to you. We will be back next month, and we will follow up on all of this. Just quickly before we sign off, though, if you are, you know, if you're just tuned in or if you've been listening this whole time, you have been listening to Labor Radio, and we are here being presented on listener-supported KBOO Community Radio. And we just want to let you know that a quick reminder to please consider donating to KBOO now and help us remain a commercial-free, volunteer-powered resource for this community. You can donate today at kboo.fm/give or by mailing your donation to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. We thank you so much for your support, and you know, community radio is such an important resource in a time where mm-hmm. funding for all such things are being just eviscerated. So please consider donating. But unfortunately, we're out of time. You've been listening to Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Have a wonderful day.
Saturday at 10 p.m. for Queery. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
It's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Queery.